Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour. A couple quick announcements. September 17th, 2015, talking about survival. And it's really true that even in just modern life, survival is a real issue. Let me give you a simple fact. Someplace like New York City, they say that there are 3 hours of food, if you call it food, on the grocery shelves at any time. The flow of food into the city, in other words, if they stopped stocking the shelves, it would take 3 hours at the normal purchasing rate to clear the shelves of goods. Now imagine in an emergency, like we've had situations where people run out and buy water or hygiene products. But in a emergency situation, those shelves are going to be cleared pronto. And these things have happened in the past, where there's flooding, where there's other emergencies, where there's a winter storm moves in and people go in and basically clear the shelves. People get nervous, so they go out and start doing panic buying, etc. But what can you do to survive? Well, first of all, everybody that I know that talks about this topic says you got to get out of the city. But I know that's where the big pay is, the jobs, that's where everybody likes to be, the younger people, that's where all the action is or whatever. But then if you're in the country, there's two things you should have besides water. And typically, if you're in the country, you would have a source of water. Chickens and sheep. No, why would I say that? Well, first of all, the chickens lay eggs, so that's a source of protein every day. Something that they also eat bugs. They also eat all kinds of things, so they kind of keep things clean, and they're a source of food. A chicken would last if you on a real survival basis. Making chicken into a stew with other vegetables, potatoes, things like that, one chicken would last quite a few people a whole week. And that's how things used to be done. People didn't eat the quantity of meat, etc., that we had today. Interestingly enough, when talked about the ancient Egyptians, talked about the end of the last era, so to speak, they talked about the Greeks having sheep. They were sheep herders that existed up in the caves up in the mountains in Greece. And those were the people who survived. But also, once again, sheep are very versatile. Or goats. Goats are even more versatile. Goats are better because you can get milk, cheese, byproducts, and then you can also use them for meat. They provide a lot of survival type of, the leather, the skins, etc. So, but the people who have goats herders, they very tough people, but they are survivors. These are in extreme situations. I'm hoping that these kind of things are not necessary. I mean, I really don't want to go back to the cave ages. I'm not sure many people who do. Most people that I know who work in, say, eco-villages or places like that want some kind of balance between modern life and basically a sustainable life that's good for the earth. And that's the end goal. If you can have modern technology, etc., the Amish don't allow their kids to have discs, etc., or computers or anything like that, simply print books. They're very particular, and the reason they believe is that those things corrupt. They're the beginning things that lead people into, say, video games or TV or breaking down that traditional, basically American lifestyle. At any rate, enough of that. Quickly, I want to talk about carrot bars and Via Viente. These are the new items that I have available on my webpage. And over the past weeks, I've been talking to people who've signed up for these, and really, it's across the board. But let me just talk about carrot bars. this is a way for the average person to obtain gold. And I'm not, a lot of this information is on my webpage, but the compensation plan, I want to talk about the compensation plan for both Via Viente and Carat Pars. It turns out that you, in Via Viente, I like what they, that's a term they have, it's called matching check. And so for every person down below you in your downline, say they make $100 or $1,000 or whatever it is in a month, you get that same amount of money in your check for the month. So your downline is really an interesting situation, and it's very simple. Via Viente is one product, is one thing, and it's very healthy. And that's why I like it myself, because I personally have experienced this in my own life. Also, Carat Pars is something that I do personally. It's owning gold on a small scale, and also making a commission while doing this. So what they're doing, instead of paying a storefront, these companies have chosen to pay the people who are out there. You know somebody, they know somebody else, and that person knows somebody else. So word of mouth, and then also no advertising. You don't have to pay for advertising because the people are doing the advertising for you. So at any rate, these are two things that I think they're health-related issues, one for your financial health, the other for your physical health. And just to recap, Via Viente has all the nutrients, minerals, vitamins, enzymes, and antioxidants that you need in a single day. It's FDA-approved. It's something that in the United States especially, you can't find food because there's no minerals, there's no food value in it. They just use ammonia fertilizers, and it looks good, but really there's no food value in the broccoli and all of the things that typically you would think would be very good for you. There's little or no food value. In the same way financially, Carat Pars is good for you financially because you can actually hold the gold yourself in gram units. But people have asked me to talk about computer currencies, and I won't mention any names because there's quite a few of them out there. And simply put, I don't have any myself. It's my particular choice not to have any. And the reason is because it's playing into the hands of computers. Your money is a number in a computer. I mean, at least with a dollar bill, you got a worthless piece of paper in your hand. I don't know. I'm just not one for computerized currency. So there's all of the various varieties out there. And unless I have something in my hand and it's gold and spendable gold, I don't consider it an option to have a money registered in a computer. Okay, well, that's enough of that. The owner of National Geographic just changed. $725 million deal. Robert Murdoch, the Fox News guy, now owns the primary share of National Geographic. Now, National Geographic has two components visible to the public. One is the National Geographic Channel. The other is the magazine that goes back, you know, when did National Geographic start with the beautiful pictures and the stories of travel and the far places in the world? I mean, National Geographic is a treasure. But right now it is being used, and there are many really positive things about it. The one thing that is not positive is science. They cover the NASA achievements, if you want to call them that, like going to other planets or visiting the solar system or whatever. They cover these and in great detail, but what they do is they promote the tier two fairy tale science pawned off on the public. And so it's odd, though, that the magazine of National Geographic, the first one that would come out under the Murdoch ownership, the cover has planets. Now, in other words, pictures of planets. It's really important to understand how huge this topic is to distort it in the eyes of the public for the average, for the world controllers, for the Rothschild banking community, etc. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail about that. They own and use science around the globe, and especially in the United States, where the vast majority of science is somehow linked and okayed through the government funding process. Now, you may have private institutions, things like that, that you might say a place like Battelle would be a private think tank. Well, no, they get the vast majority of their money through government funding, backdoor deals and things where you just don't see black ops contracts, etc. And so the ownership of science and the distortion of science in the very top of their list is comets. And that may sound funny, but it's really not, because comets are the things that historically have caused a great deal of damage to Earth in historical times, etc. Venus was a large comet. We just had Hale-Bopp. I've talked about that in my July 23, 2015 release, the Hale-Bopp Planet X Harrington Expedition update. And they are so afraid that the public is going to find out the truth about these. Just looked on the spaceweather.com, and there was a small comet that went crashing into the sun yesterday, the 16th, caused a minor bit of solar activity after the collision. And they are so intent on saying icy little ball, and it was vaporized by the sun. I mean, let's be honest, boys and girls, there's no sensors, there's no detectors or anything out by the sun, and they don't have any clue. The comets that we have visited with spacecraft, there's no ice, there's no snow, but they keep promoting this dirty snowball concept. Why? Because if you knew in mass, if all of the people out there, in fact, my audience is educated, but if the average Joe on the street, or Sally or Sue, whoever, woke up one day and saw that comets were not dirty snowballs, that they were, in fact, discharges of the solar capacitor, that comets indicate that we have vast amounts of electrical energy in outer space around us, and we could tap into this for our energy needs, all of a sudden you're hitting at the big things. Also, if you found out that comets were the source of oil and water, I'll be talking about that a little later, talking about adiabatic oil, this idea that oil is somehow formed magically under the ground, just is not true. And even if it were true, let's play devil's advocate. I like doing that. Say that ringwoodite, which they claim there's vast oceans of water down there, or adiabatic oil, it somehow oil magically forms under the ground tens of thousands of feet down. Say that did work. What good is it going to do for you and me and our energy needs? Well, it's not going to do anything, because the pools of oil, the resources of oil that they're tapping on, have been around for a very long time, some of them 10,000 feet under the surface of the Earth. That's how deep they're going. I think the BP oil well in the Gulf of Mexico was something like 15,000 feet down. Tremendous distance they're going. But is adiabatic oil production, even if it exists, going to contribute to adding more oil to the oil supply at the time frame we need it? No. Absolutely not. The same thing with ringwoodite, that they claim there's vast oceans of water underground. Well, let me tell you, boys and girls, it's very, very, very hot down there. And if there were water there, it would be steam, and steam doesn't like to hang around. It likes to blow things up. And so there's an experiment that was conducted in an engineering lab. They took a foot diameter solid sphere of steel, solid steel, and the engineering students drilled a hole down to the center of the steel globe. And then they took a threading bit and created threads in there so they could put a bolt in there. And they put one drop of water down that hole. They turned the screw in and capped it tight so it was sealed. Now they heat the ball of steel up beyond the boiling point of water. In that one drop of water, when it expanded, it cracked that steel ball in two. That's what water does when it gets hot. It ain't going to hang around. And so to imagine that there are somehow oceans of water deep down in the earth because of this Ringwood ideal is just folly. And as I said, with adiabatic oil, if it were a source of oil, which it is not, there's no proof for it, because how are you going to get measurement materials down there? These are people speculating that there's a process that could exist. Even if it did exist, it wouldn't produce oil for our energy needs at the scale we're using oil. Oil comes from comet tails. Earth itself developed into comet tails at times. We develop into a comet tail regularly when solar flares occur, when we have very severe weather, when we align with comets, when the moon aligns either full moon or new moon. All the time, the Earth is actually becoming acting like a comet. It was very interesting when I predicted that Pluto would exhibit cometary phenomenon, signs, etc. I was exactly right. From a distance, you could see Pluto and its five moons. All the five moons, as they orbited Pluto, showed comet tails. Pluto itself showed comet tails. And when NASA begrudgingly, and the creeping crud, as I call them, released that information that Pluto had a comet tail, not only was it observed from a distance, but the plasma detectors on the spacecraft detected the plasma tail and the comet tail, and they had to admit that Pluto has a comet tail. What's it doing with a comet tail out there? The sun is so weak, there's no way to create a comet tail at Pluto. It's absolutely absurd. But they also coyly admitted that Venus and Mars have comet tails. Typically, in traditional sense of space science, astronomy, astrophysics, they would talk about magnetic tails, like Earth has this magnetic tail, they say, in Jupiter, and they talk about magnetic reconnection, which is another myth of modern science. But they would say that the planets that have magnetic fields have this magnetosheath and therefore a tail. Well, Venus and Mars and literally Pluto do not have magnetic fields. They don't have significant magnetic fields. So how on Earth can they have a magnetic tail? They have a tail, and so there's only one thing to call it, and that's a comet tail. That's because they're all discharging the solar capacitor. And so that is where oil comes from. When we pass through the tail of a very large comet, we get this huge influx of oil. And that's what happened during the Venus event. Every ancient text that comes down to us on planet Earth talks about the burning fire in naphtha that comes in from above. The fire is when that hydrocarbon chains, when they hit the Earth's upper atmosphere and they meet the oxygen, and you're also having electrical discharge going on at the same time. It ignites the oil, and it burns as it comes in. So that's the and also the meteor streams. That's where the burning rocks and fire and brimstone being the rocks that are covered with oil burning as they come in. Fire and brimstone is the term, and that's what the ancients saw. So at any rate, that's where oil comes from on planet Earth. The whole topic here started because I was talking about the National Geographic conversion to ownership by Robert Murdoch of Fox News. So I can tell you, you're going to get nothing but pure baloney out of National Geographic. Now, they're going to still have pretty pictures. I love their travel articles, etc. But comes to science, you're going to get pure tier 2 fairy tale science. Simple Simon, silly science meant for the general public. By the way, I appreciate the listener who sent that in. Many people send in comments every week or things that they've seen out there. I can't be everywhere on the internet, so it's really wonderful when the fans send this information in and get to use it on the air, use it as a springboard to discuss these topics. Along with that, I should read off the laundry list of other Tier 2 fairy tale science journals and magazines and glossy magazines and TV channels. Discover Magazine has to be right at the very top. Glossy Magazine, also Internet, Total Misinformation. Many people may not think that this would be Wired Magazine, terribly, terribly disoriented disinformation magazine, trying to steer the public away from anything real. Lots of gee whiz in there, not a lot of real. History Channel 1 and 2, National Geographic, the TV channel, the cable channel, and then the magazine itself. Scientific American, Sky and Telescope, Astronomy Magazine, plus many, many more. And there's a lot of newspapers, daily newspapers that come out. The Daily Mail is probably the worst that I've seen. And then all of the other laundry list of internet newspapers. Science News has been around for a long time, claiming to be the weekly authority on science news. But once again, playing that NASA drum. There's a thing called the Drake Equation. And I saw this mentioned on this once again sent in by a listener, who's talking about Mars, now stating that Mars had this catastrophic event, lost its ocean. And, of course, that's what I've been saying all along. The Michael Muma theft of my material in NASA, where they took my material, basically wholesale published it in NASA as a new discovery. Michael Muma of Goddard Space Flight Center and his lackey student who got credit for this, saying that Mars has oceans, but there's evidence of it. Well, of course there's evidence. It's all over the place. But then they claim it's billions of years ago. That's the catch. That's the Tier 2 fairy tale science catch. But now they got a joker over in England who's saying that, it lost its oceans due to a catastrophe. Oh, that sounds interesting, because what I had said all along, it was the Venus event, and it was recent, that took the oceans off of Mars, and you can see all the riverbeds, even though Mars has these tremendous dust storms that would destroy the geology in a short period of time, that proves that the Mars oceans were recent. So anyway, this guy says that there was a catastrophe, but he doesn't say what the catastrophe is. It just says catastrophe. But anyway, in his ramblings, he brings up the Drake Equation. Now, the Drake Equation was a guy named Frank Drake. I believe he worked at Cornell. And there were many factors in the Drake Equation. For example, you take the number of galaxies in the universe, multiply times the average number of stars in a galaxy, and then you look at the number of planets per star average, and then you try and make an estimate of how many are inhabitable planets that could support intelligent life, and then how many of those planets would have an intelligent species at the given time when we're here and looking at them. And then out of all of this, they multiply all of these factors together, and they get a number estimating the number of intelligent life systems that exist in the universe at a given time. But then you have to figure out also the possibility that they might be signaling in our direction or something like that, saying, ET phone home type of things. But they forgot one factor. And so I just coyly named it the McCanny factor. And at the end of all of these factors is a big fat goose egg zero. Now, and it goes like this. If you are someone that was signaling out there and signaling to us saying, hey, here we are, look at us, we're an intelligent species, we're just starting to become spaceborne, I would consider them to be the dumbest rocks in the universe, because that's the last thing you would do, to signal someone out there, because no doubt outer space and the universe is a pretty wily place. And there's probably some characters out there that you probably wouldn't want to meet, let alone signal and say, hey, we're here. Look at, we just got our first rocket built. We got our first antenna built. We're NASA. We're going to signal and say, hello. bad idea. And so my Drake equation factor, the McCanny factor in the Drake equation, is zero. If you detect anybody signaling out there, I wouldn't want to know them, because they'd have to be as stupid as NASA. And so what I would say is that there are obviously many intelligent species out there. And you might say, okay, prove that there is alien life in the universe. Prove that there is alien life. And I'd say, okay, I can prove it right now, right here on this radio station. I will prove 100% pure positive that there is intelligent alien life out there. And it's called the human race. We are the aliens. We are building spacecraft. We're spacefaring. We're going out. We're putting effort into this. And even though we have a very black ops operation that's doing a lot more than you'll ever know about, or you or me, the fact is that we are, in fact, aliens by the virtue of the fact that we are going out into space seeking, you know, I mean, we conceive of shows like Star Trek and, you know, the Star Wars series. That's what it's all about. But we are the ones adventuring out there. So literally, that proves 100% there are aliens. Have they visited us in little flying saucers? Well, as a scientist, I have not personally witnessed that. And so I cannot personally tell you that that's true or not. But I'll tell you with a high degree of confidence, yep, it's going on. And that's why my book, The Diamond Principle, talks about this, is that the universe is universal. It's repetitive, etc. But at any rate, the last factor on the Drake equation is zero. So no matter how many intricate and calculable factors you factor into the Drake equation, the final factor in the Drake equation is the McCanny factor, and that's zero. And then when you multiply them all together, it equals zero. Intelligent beings are not going to signal us and say, hi, here we are. If they're here, they're very congenial by just letting us go on with the madness that's going on Earth. But I have a feeling, and I say this in all of my books, it's the Will Man Survive chapter, which is, I believe, in all of my books. Not the Calculate Primes book, of course. But the question is, will man survive? And I come to the conclusion that no. Man is too busy fighting petty wars and with all kinds of creating economic systems, every diversion under the planet, kids playing video games. Man is not serious about surviving at all. Not at all as a species. Because you need to get hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people, autonomously into outer space for the species to survive. Not a few military guys. Not a few military women, lots and lots, hundreds of thousands, millions of people in autonomous space stations where if Earth gets pummeled, wiped out, that part of the human species would survive and could eventually come back or possibly populate another planet eventually. But given that that's not the case, we're doomed. Human race is doomed because of fiddling around with video games, driving SUVs up and down the street to go to work every day, useless jobs that don't amount to anything, are there ever diversions in front of you? Wow. I mean, it's just unbelievable. This coming week is September 22nd. I think you all know by now, listening to all kinds of radio shows, what day that is. It's the same day in the Jewish calendar of 9/11, 2001. This is just 14 years later. But the next day, Pope, the little Pope there, who fronts the Rothschild banking community, by the way, is going to make a little visit to New York City. Now, there's been a lot of hype about this, but really what it is it's the economic 9/11. 14 years ago, we had a physical political 9/11 in which they politically took over the United States. The upcoming 9/11, which is going to be September 23rd when the Pope visits, is an economic 9/11, economic and social. In other words, the social structure of the world, which is spearheaded by the United States, is going to have a major change. And so this is symbolic. I would be surprised if buildings come down this time, but you never know. But that's what's going on. So I'm not a lot more to say about that. The main science topic that I want to talk about tonight are the latest photos from Pluto. Pluto is a little planet that sits out at the edge of the solar system, and yes, it is a planet. Just to give you a brief summary, the New Horizons spacecraft passed Pluto and in July. It was a few-hour encounter, so all of the pictures, etc., had to be taken very quickly, but for months prior to that, they were snapping pictures of Pluto and its moon system. There are now five known moons of Pluto. And I predicted that they would act like comets, and that was exactly what they found. There was a three-layer atmosphere, which is exactly the same atmosphere as a comet. A comet has three atmospheres. If it's a physically large object like the size of Pluto, then it has enough gravitational mass to maintain an actual average an atmosphere just like Earth's, even though it's relatively faint compared to Earth's, and very faint compared to, say, Venus, which has a very massive atmosphere, probably 100 times denser than Earth's. The second atmosphere of Pluto is the comet tail, broad-scale comet tail, and also the moons all have comet tails. This is material that's being drawn in by the discharge of the solar capacitor. And the reason this is very notable out by Pluto is because it's on the very inner edge of the nebular ion cloud, which I predicted in my work in 1979 when I was talking about the structure of the solar system with the plasma discharge comet model. I also had to define how the solar system worked. One of the aspects was the excess positive current in the solar wind, which the protons hold back the cloud of dust and gases out beyond the orbit of Pluto, and the Pluto is just right on the edge of that, so it's drawing in this material and causing it to act like a comet. The third atmosphere of Pluto is much larger. It's typically a hydrogen or low atomic mass ion cloud, and it's in the form of a large circle or globe, sphere, very spherical. And so these are the three atmospheres of Pluto, and in fact, they detected these. But what's very interesting about Pluto are the surface features. Now, I grew up in Minnesota, haven't really been there for a while, but as a kid, I saw the lakes freeze, I saw them thaw, and there's a pattern of ice that you see in the springtime when the lakes have been frozen solid, and they start to thaw, they start to break up in kind of little islands, and all these islands are interconnected, and they are floating somewhat independently. And so if in the very early spring you could walk from one to the other, and they would kind of move up and down in the water independently, and you could actually, if you wanted, walk right across the lake on these. Not a good idea. In fact, I was once with some friends, and we went up in a boat up on one of the Canadian border lakes in the very early springtime, and we pushed our way through these little floating islands of ice. And so I'm more than completely familiar with this type of ice structure, how the lakes break up in the springtime. Then there's a term called black ice. And what happens is the water forms kind of like little icicles. They're like hexagonal shape, and they kind of separate, and so you have all of this ice, and so your island now becomes thousands of little icicles all loose next to each other. And then finally one day you get a big wind and it blows it all up to the shore. And the day they call ice out, there's actually a definition. You'd think, well, that's the day when there's no more ice on the lake. But no, the definition of ice out in Minnesota, where they actually keep track of this, and especially on some of the bigger lakes because the people want to go fishing, they say ice out and there's a date. And they actually keep track of the date of ice out for all of the lakes around the state because the fishermen want to know that, because they have their favorite lake where they like to go fishing. So they want to know the ice out date. But the definition of ice out in Minnesota is that the you can go in a boat all around the shoreline and see the shoreline. So you can actually circumnavigate the lake around the right next to the shoreline completely without being blocked by a chunk of ice. That is official ice out date. And now on some of the bigger lakes, they actually do this. They measure it by airplane. So these are just a couple of fun facts about water, the way water breaks up. That's what we see on Pluto. But, of course, NASA scientists don't know anything about this, and so they're scratching various body parts trying to figure this out. So what do we see on Pluto? We see an ocean. An ocean on Pluto? That's interesting. With nitrogen mixed with water ice. That's interesting. We see the ice breaking up, like we see lakes up in the upper Midwestern states, into little islands. And these islands are there. We see water flows, river flows coming down from the land, the higher lands off the ocean. We see channels where material, it's hard to say, like a glaciated material possibly, had carved out whole channels down to the ocean region. And there are mountains. Now, what are the mountains? Well, that's another thing that happens if you look at the way ice is managed on a lake. If you get a wind from one direction, or in the case of Pluto, possibly another passing planet or something out there, then you get the ice, a tidal wave, and it builds up these mountains of ice off at one side. And they're all around one side, basically. These mountains of ice. So that's what we're seeing on Pluto. But that begs the question, where does the heat come from? Ain't no sun out there, boys and girls. There is no sun at Pluto. Pluto is a planet that is so far from the sun that, now how could it act like a comet? It could not possibly act like a comet because it's so far from the sun, according to standard science. According to my plasma discharge comet model, of course it can act like a planet because it's discharging the solar capacitor right out at the edge where all of that available ion material, ionic dust, ionized dust, positively charged dust can flow in to the negatively charged planet. And all of the moons, they're all discharging the solar capacitor out there and building up. The one comment that is true that's coming out of NASA is that Pluto and Charon, the biggest moon of Pluto, are showing signs of being extremely young. Well, how does this happen? But once again, how do you have ice on Pluto that isn't just frozen so solid that, there's some level of heat out there? Because let me tell you, at Pluto, if you looked around and took a look at the sun, and I'm surprised that NASA hasn't done this yet, but if you took your spacecraft, turned it around, and looked at the sun while there's not a lot to see, it's going to look just about like another star. That's how far away Pluto is. It's going to look really, really small. And secondly, there's no energy coming from the sun in terms of light, because the cross-section of Pluto is so small. So how do you get energy out there? Well, it's called Joule heating. It's the discharge of the solar capacitor. It's electrical current. Let me tell you what would happen to the atmosphere of Pluto if there were no Joule heating and replenishing of atmosphere from the nebular ion cloud. What would happen? Well, if you didn't have the Joule heating, the atmosphere would freeze, crystallize, and everything, the nitrogen, the oxygen, whatever is in the atmosphere, certainly water, certainly ammonia, any other chemical, would crystallize and simply fall to the ground. It would not exist in a atmospheric state. So the end result is that, number one, Pluto has a source of heat. The source of heat is the Joule heating from the electrical current of the discharge of the solar capacitor. And also that's bringing in fresh water. This causes the Pluto to become negatively charged, just like the plasma discharge comet model says, and allows this activity where you have an ocean that's between freezing and thawing for the temperature. Apparently a nitrogen base with water in it. Very interesting combination. Very unlike, for example, Titan, the large moon of Saturn, which has nitrogen oceans, but pure nitrogen. It doesn't appear to be, at least they haven't detected as far as I've read, water mixed in. So Pluto offers up some very interesting enigmas, but it's obviously getting the water, etc., from the local environment out there. It's getting the heat to maintain the elevated temperatures that cause the surface to break up, etc. So anyway, very interesting. You also see riverbeds. You also see something very interesting is a bit of cratering. Now, one would think that out by Pluto, there's not a whole lot of activity relative to asteroids or other things crashing into the planet. The question is, are these impact craters or are these due to electrical discharges, say when solar flares pass by that region? Could that ignite the moons to discharge to the planetary surface? Or other possibly passing objects, but it's in the remotest area of the solar system. Hard to imagine that there's a lot of passing activity out there, although there could be, but also raises the possibility that discharges between the moons and the planet Pluto are occurring on a regular basis because they are overriding the other geology on Pluto, but also, you can see where some of them have weathered and are old in terms of being covered up, being completely emaciated by the geological activity. So, once again, Pluto, a very strange place. The pictures that are coming out from Pluto, very photoshopped, very limited. But what they do show is that Pluto has a very young surface. That doesn't mean it's a young planet. That just means it's continually renewing, rejuvenating its surface. Very interesting. Once again, I should mention that the unheralded people of the space program are those engineers who you never see, never hear about. They're in the background. They work in the aerospace industry building those wonderful machines. The only problem I see with that is that they should be building hundreds, not onesie twosies. They should be building hundreds of these so that they're out there all the time searching in various parts of the solar system. It's something that's been completely missing from the visible space program since its inception. Changing topics just a second here. this came out this past week, and I'm sorry to do all this NASA bashing here, but it's really unfortunate that all of our money is being spent on this idiocy. There's a lot of really good science that has to be done. And this next story, NASA is pretending to be an innovator in electric airplanes. And they have some pilot programs where they have many propellers on the wing of an airplane. And they're calling this an amazing advancement, will be radically changed the way we view outer flight and et cetera, airplanes. The only problem is, sorry to break the news to you, NASA, but there's already commercial electric airplanes on the market. I could buy one today if I had enough money. So there's nothing innovative, new, or exciting about what they're doing. And besides, don't use propellers, use ducted fans. Those are the propulsion system of choice when it comes to electric airplanes. They're much more efficient. I want to turn my attention now to the wing generator project. And so many people are wondering where this is at. The 12-meter model is moving forward. I don't have a commercialization date, but the design has been finalized, and there's some other there's always a tweaking that has to be done, but some very important design considerations are now history. Things are moving forward, so but I'll keep people posted as that progresses. What I wanted to mention now is that, first of all, I'm extremely happy about something. When I decided to release this, and as you know, if you've been following this, I had made some attempts in the past to get venture capital funding for this project from private sources. And on both occasions, these fell through. So I'm so tired of dealing with financial people with no scientific background. I will never, ever, ever do that again. It's just a huge mistake. But at any rate, so when I released the wing generator to the public, I did it with an open architecture. This is not open source. This is open architecture where anybody could take the architecture and through royalty fees build it and then produce their own working models. In fact, compete against me if they want. I would like nothing more than somebody to come up with a design that's better than mine. But then, of course, pay me royalty fees because that's part of the agreement, because this is a new design, etc. But people are doing this, and this is the beauty of this, because that is why it's going to succeed. It's a mistake. It would be a very big mistake for me to say, well, I'm going to hire the best engineers. I'm going to try and do the best product possible. That's a mistake, because you don't know who down the line, just a common person, or somebody that's, say, done welding all of their life or been around other types of equipment, would have a better idea for how to do a certain thing than I would, or my whole team of expensive engineers. So that's why it was important to let this thing out there and just let it fly. So that's very important. The other thing is that makes it very difficult target for the powers that rule the energy world, makes it a very difficult target for them to destroy. And so I'm very happy to say right now that the wing generator is out there in many facets, being developed by many groups of people, and some of them in just small companies, some of them in their garage, literally, or their work facility. Some of them have nice work facilities they're working in. But the point is that this design is the design that'll take us into the next century, the next 100 centuries, with completely unbilled electrical bills. And we can convert, I don't say free energy because that has too many bad connotations. But the point is, with the wind, we will have enough energy to power all of our needs. And then what you're going to see is people starting to conserve. Now that you don't have energy bills attached to everything, driving the price of a hot dog from 3 cents up to $2, that type of thing, because at every stage of the way, energy is involved in that energy. It's literally an energy tax or surcharge on every step of the way of any kind of product, whether it's popcorn or peanuts or hot dogs or automobiles or solar panels or whatever it is. It takes energy to build it. Those costs are inherent in the final product. Drill to drill holes in the wall, I mean, whatever it is, it takes energy. And if we eliminate the burning of nuclear, coal, and natural gas as our primary sources of electricity, and then eliminate gasoline as a use, primary use, or diesel and gasoline for transportation, and have it being directly powered with a very efficient system from the wind, all of a sudden your work requirement is going to go way down. The need for you to work a 40-hour week is going to go way down, and people can start to be live like actual real people. And so I'm very happy to say that this is out there and running. The wing generator is out there and in many facets out there and running. I want to compare it to something I did a number of years ago. I think it was 2008. If some of you remember the corn seed sale, and many of you people bought the corn seeds, I sold 250 seeds in a bag, all the way up to 5,000 seeds in a bag. And these sold all over the world, except for places like Australia that wouldn't let them in. There are places that Monsanto has already legally bottled up. But those seeds went everywhere. And people were growing them. I got pictures back from people that they had ears of corn like a foot and a half long. This woman, I posted a picture on my webpage. This woman is holding a corn cob, and it's literally, it's like a foot and a half long, just huge. And that's what grew. And they were getting their second and third generation corn, etc., from the saving their seeds. So that was something that I'm very proud of. That means that real corn has been preserved. The real Dent corn, which, now let me explain where Dent corn comes from. Dent corn comes from, basically all corn comes from from Mexico, where it was originated as a small, actually grain, many, who knows how many tens of thousands of years ago. But then it evolved through natural selection, through selecting the best seeds, the biggest seeds, and growing them, and it got bigger and bigger. In Mexico, there's probably about 20 varieties of original corn. And then if you come up into the American Southwest, there's many more. But there's probably, you know, of varieties that I personally have myself, there's probably 30 varieties of corn that evolved. And then a couple of those strains were brought together by basically cross-pollinating. And that's what gave us the two strains of corn. One is called field corn, and that's the Dent corn. It's not sweet corn. It just doesn't have as much sugar content as sweet corn. But basically, when the corn dries after the growing season and the corn is still on the husk, it's still on the plant out in the field, and it dries, that sugar changes into starch. And then the seeds become viable, and that's when you pick the corn to create the new crop seed for the next year. And you do something, you take the middle rows of seeds, or the middle section of the corn cob, you take that, you break off the two ends, and you can eat the two ends or feed them to the animals or whatever. But the center part is where you get the seeds for the next crop. And so the people are doing this. The wing generator project is very similar. When I released this, I wanted this thing to be eternal. I wanted this thing to go on and on, and I wanted it into the hands of the public so that all of you out there, the people that have the ability, could take this thing and run with it and make sure that it couldn't be stomped out or patented or killed or whatever they do with energy devices these days. In the world of energy, if it doesn't work, it gets funded. If it doesn't work, it gets promoted. If it works, they're going to try and bury it so far that you'll never see the light of day. So I had to release it in a way that it would prosper and grow. And so that's what I did, basically released it. And then why would I be so greedy as to want money for this? Well, the reason is because I want to do more of my projects. I have a long list of other projects that are on my table, and the money will help me do that. So that is my greed factor, if you want to call it that. I don't get government grants. I never did. I'm not getting money from private investors or venture capitalists. Don't want anything to do with the greedy. You know what? You fill in the blank there. I don't want anything to do with those people. All they want is a return on investment, and they're not good corporate partners. People out there, they're just regular people. I've gotten to talk to many of them now. I just love talking to the people that are just regular people, because you know that they're not going to, you know, take you to the cleaners. They're going to be honest. They're going to develop something, and when it comes time to contribute back to me, they're going to do it because they're very happy. They've gotten basically a business that's going to last forever out of thin air. And so I know these people are very thankful. And also they understand that they're doing this to help the world. So this is more than just building another product, another better mousetrap, and putting it on the market. This is all about curing our energy problem. So with that little dissertation, I hope everybody is waiting for the outcome of the, especially the 12-meter Pegasus model, which, like I say, as soon as that's ready to go, there are people standing in line that want to sell it, people standing in line that want to install them, buy them, and et cetera. So very interesting. Once again, let me just say, now, these are three major events, not the least of which, these are just side issues in all of the work that I'm doing. I'm still doing a lot of work in the background on my other project. But the Carrot Bars, the Via Viente, I really like those products. To me, they're the best. And so I hope people take a look at those. And they're both for the products. The first thing is to understand that these are for your health. One is for the financial, your financial help. One is for your physical health. And then the wing generator, if you go buy water filters or any products on my webpage, I'm still contributing 50% of my profits, putting that into the wing generator project to keep that funded and moving along. So you can get great products at reduced prices. I still have the 10% sale on 10 packs of water filter elements, etc. Plus 50% of the profits go into the wing generator project. So, once again, the end of another exciting week in the world of space science, astronomy, and planet Earth. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.